Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm very pleased to have as my guest Jane Smiley. Her new book is Private Life. It's published by Knopf. The whole novel is seen through the eyes of a woman, Margaret, trapped in a disastrous, nightmarish marriage to a self-centered scientist named Andrew. Through her eyes, we watch American culture shape itself from the end of the Civil War through World War I to the beginning of World War II. There she is, living on Mare Island, the peninsula just northeast of San Francisco. She's close to the heart of the San Francisco earthquake. She watches the build-up to the World War from the U.S. Navy's shipyard. But most importantly, through her eyes, we vibrantly see what a sexless marriage is like with a self-absorbed, self-proclaimed genius who can't see another person's point of view. Jane Smiley, what drew you after having written a book full of sex in Beverly Hills
to the repressions?
No, yes.
Well, the seed was of the fact that my grandfather, who was the youngest of 10 children, had four older sisters, many of whom were quite a bit older than he was, and one of whom was married to really a quite notorious mad scientist. And she, in our family, she was just seen as this lovely old lady who drove an old Franklin and was always fun to be with. And she had this husband, and he was just Uncle Tom. But I thought, wow, what an interesting story that must have been. I only knew the outlines of it. And I never met either one of them. But I thought, since they lived on Mare Island, which is really at the heart of, let's say, the quote-unquote American war machine, all from about the 1860s through the Second World War, because it was a shipbuilding factory for the Navy on the Pacific coast. I thought how interesting her life was to have gone from central Missouri, a relatively quiet though interesting place, to this amazing, bustling, strange place on the coast of California, and to have thrived there and enjoyed herself very much. So it just drew me in, the kind of strangeness of that progress of hers.
Now, the most famous mad scientist in literature, well, maybe Dr. Frankenstein comes
maybe,
first.
Yeah.
But that's Mr.
He is a biologist.
But I think of Mr. Casaubon from Middlemarch, who has his theory of the universe.
Yes, he's a folklorist.
Yes, but it's the most terrible marriage in the world with someone who believes he knows the origins of everything there is to know.
Yes, and he even but my person, my mad scientist, is an astronomer. He begins as an astronomer. And he would probably have gone on as an astronomer, except that he's so hard to get along with by his colleagues. And so bit by bit, he has moved away from the telescopes that you need to have in order to see deeply into space. And he becomes stuck with this little 5-inch telescope on Mare Island. And his only job in the course of the day is to tell the time. He figures out exactly what time it is. And then exactly noon, a sailor goes up to the tower and drops the time ball, and all the ships in the harbor synchronize their watches. And that's his job. So he can't do the thing he had wanted to do, which is to be an astronomer. So what does he do? He's got plenty of time on his hands and plenty of mental capacity. So he does the thing that so many people do when they're ambitious. He does the most ambitious thing, which is to become a cosmologist.
Yes, a cosmologist is a physicist who studies the formation and evolution of the universe.
Yes. The other thing about him is that he feels that he must defend. He's maybe a half a generation or a little more older than Albert Einstein. And he's slightly out of sync with the world of physics and astronomy of his day because he's a little bit too old. And so he falls into the role of defending the old style, which is Newtonian physics. And Newtonian physics makes perfect sense to him. He doesn't see why it should be superseded by crazy ideas about the identical nature of time and distance. So by his own lights, they're crazy and he's sane, you know. But he just was superseded, you know. That's the way it was. And he was unable, maybe because he couldn't get along with colleagues or whatever, he was unable to move forward into the 20th century.
And the book captures that oddness that occurs when someone, a husband, mm-hmm. is controlling thought as he grows more aware that his ideas are rejected. Mm-hmm. A very slow process, by the mm-hmm. way. He demands and wants his wife to be supportive of him.
Yes, he wants believers. And every so often a believer comes along. One of them is a biographer who comes out to California and interviews him. So every so often a believer comes along. But really, he's irritable. He's made irritable by the idea of the disagreement. You know, this is the thing that happens to people. They become more and more invested in their ideas, and as they do, they become more and more irritated by those who disagree with them. And maybe if he lived in an academic community or something, the brushing up of people who could have been in disagreement with him, maybe he could have learned to tolerate it. But, you know, everything reconfirms and reconfirms and reconfirms that he's an isolated person, an isolated scientist outside of the mainstream, and he really feels himself to be a genius. How could he be wrong?
And it's a very scary and funny subject. And what's interesting about private life is how funny, creepy it is almost all the time in equal measures. You're not sure whether to laugh mm-hmm. or feel terrible pity.
I think that's what Margaret feels too. You know, there's one point in the story where she's really angry at him and she feels that it has been proved to her sort of unequivocally that he is a fool. But then subsequently to that, she has a moment of real insight into the way his mind works. And then she feels that he's to be pitied more than ridiculed. But she, you know, what's she going to do? She's going to go back and forth between one or the other. She can't. He hasn't developed, and maybe hasn't the capacity for, an actual intimacy with her, an actual relationship with her. And so she's left as a little bit of an outsider in terms of his inner life. And as an outsider, and indeed from his point of view, her only job is to accept, to judge, because in his world, that's what people do. They judge one another. They don't have an intimate sort of relationship. He never shows any actual interest in her. In fact, he's kind of amazed that she has an inner life. And there's another character in the book who in most books would be just a bounder, you know, clearly suspicious guy. But he has a couple of talents, and one of them is to actually be interested, to ask her about herself and to listen when she tells and to respond. And that's one of the few people she knows who has ever done that.
I'm talking to Jane Smiley about her novel Private Life, the story of a decades-long marriage between a complicated and domineering failed scientist and his simpler, much more reticent wife. And we've been talking about a marriage in which the balance of objectivity is impossible to assess. Mm-hmm. Now, this has been your subject since the age of grief. Your 1987 novella about the end of a relationship.
Oh, really?
Marriage as siege. Marriage as, you know, a marriage that goes from the point of being just a marriage to that inflamed point where it seems like a version of the cosmos.
Well, I think all marriages go through crisis periods, and especially if one of the partners is quite a sensitive person. And then in that crisis period, one or the other partner basically says, are you with me or are you against me? You know, because that partner feels so vulnerable that they need to be shored up. The problem for Andrew is that he is almost always in a crisis.
Now, let's take a step back. We're at the beginning of the century. It's 1903 approximately. Mm-hmm. They are both late marriers.
Mm-hmm. He's 40 and she's about 29.
Their families have suspected that they won't, in fact, marry.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret's been
thought to be
the old maid.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, somehow or other, at least in the local newspaper, he's thought to be the most brilliant man the area has yet produced.
And he is in many ways. I mean, he goes to the local university. He goes to the state university. He sort of outstrips them. He looks around for another place to go, and he ends up at the University of Berlin, which is extremely prestigious. He has plenty of promise, but he's extremely pugnacious, and he feels this is an essential part of his genius.
And we're going to be moving in this book from the battles that ensue post-Civil War, the people who remain still supportive of the rebel cause, to World War I, and all the way to World War II. And in a way, the book plays private life against the tapestry, the ongoing panorama of public life. And there are set pieces that are quite extraordinary.
Well, I wanted to do a longitudinal book. I didn't want to do a retrospective book. I wanted to talk about their marriage as it progresses and as it appears to them as it is progressing. Every marriage is a mystery, but it's certainly much more of a mystery while you're involved in it and you don't know where it's headed. For most people alive, history is shaping them at every moment. Many historical novels take main actors in that history and write about them or talk about them. And then there are other kinds of novels that pretend that history isn't happening. It's just the only thing that's happening is a personal life. But if I was going to do this longitudinal picture of a marriage, well, the history has to come in, and it has to come in from one of the characters' points of view. I wasn't going to have this third voice saying, you know, and then World War II happened, you know, this third narrative, much more objective narrative voice. I wanted Margaret to experience the things about history that were happening. And so that was part of my purpose.
There's a strange quality in the prose here, especially at the beginning of the book. It's the prose of the 19th century rustic novel.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, as Margaret comes to be educated, the prose changes. And it's no longer a prose of doilies, lace, and anti-massacres, you know, those little cloths placed on the backs of chairs and sofas as a protection against hair oils.
Anti-maskers go by the wayside, you know. And other things enter her consciousness. I mean, she's an uneducated girl who reads a lot of books and lives in a small town. Now, it's not uneventful, this small town, because it's Missouri after the Civil War. And gangs of bushwhackers and people left over from the Civil War are still around and still working out their profound resentments about the war, and it's a violent place. And yet it's not worldly in the sense that it's cosmopolitan or educated in any way. And so as Margaret emerges from that world into the larger world as represented by San Francisco, her way of perceiving things has to change. And there are people who help her. For example, the first person that she meets when she gets to Mare Island is her next-door neighbor, who's an extremely worldly daughter of a naval captain, married to a naval captain, who's been everywhere, eats anything, lets the children run wild purposefully because they're going to be naval boys, you know. So, yes, let them walk along the railings of the third floor of the house to improve their balance, you know. And so Margaret is semi-astonished and semi-attracted by all of these people that she meets who have been so many more places than she has and seen so many more things.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Jane Smiley, the author most recently of Private Life. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Jane Smiley about her novel, Private Life. Told from a woman's point of view, the book takes us from the end of the Civil War and follows the disastrous marriage of an ordinary woman and a domineering failed genius. It's a novel that I would say is strange and thrilling because you fall into an abyss. A very tiny one, but a real abyss between...
A black hole, let's call
it. A black hole between people.
Mm-hmm.
Are Margaret's perceptions of the unsufferability of this man accurate? Or is it merely, that he is too overwhelming and really of a different class of people? This is a marriage that might not have taken place 20 years later in an urban setting.
I think a lot of women in all generations are drawn to catching the big fish, marrying the big one, without realizing or grasping what that's going to entail and how their own identity, their own sense of whom they are, could be threatened by the ambition and the intelligence. It's not just that he's intelligent. It's that his intelligence is all-consuming. He can't simply have a conversation with another person. He has to investigate that person, you know, and then come to some profound understanding of that person and then announce his investigations. And I sort of see that in myself as a novelist, you know. I'm always curious. I'm always inquisitive. I'm always asking questions. And so there's a part of me that's in Andrew, too. But he's also 6'6". He's incredibly healthy. Nothing ever stops him. There's nothing he's ever not wanted to do. There's nothing he's ever wanted to do that he's failed at. For example, as a young man, he loved looking at birds, and then he would draw the birds. You know, it looked like the birds he was looking at. So he's one of those people who's really good at a lot of things, and yet his ambitions continually outstrip his skills or the acceptance, at least, of his skills. And he has put all of his eggs in this very enormous basket, which is, you know, understanding the nature of the universe. And it has to be the universe because that's the only thing that would contain his ego.
Now, what seems so nice to me about this book, in a way, is related to a misunderstanding about it. Many of the people reading it think that it's a novel about what a marriage was like prior to women's liberation.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's not. It's about what a marriage is like, given what people are like.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
And it's not a book that is a reminder of what it used to be.
An evocation of the old days. But in all over the world, people are still getting married in arranged marriages. They're still getting married without knowing a thing about the other person. They're still embarking on a whole life with maybe two or three bits of information. So, you know, it's still, I would say, current. What I really wanted to do, though, among other things, was there are so many books about geniuses who are finally proved correct, but I'm sure those geniuses are way outnumbered by the number of geniuses who are finally proved incorrect. So what's it like to be one of those guys? You know, what's it like not to get the recognition that you feel you deserve?
And even, you know, in one of my favorite scenes, he has been, as usual, studying the atmosphere around him. He's gone out on expeditions, and one afternoon he's given Margaret a pile of papers to read in which his discovery that he believes that she has been unwittingly at the center of a ring of spies.
Yes.
And that all of her friends are using her.
Yeah, to get at him.
Yes, to get at his papers. And she's read this while he's taken a walk, and he says, well, what do you think?
And she says, why are you asking me? And he says, well, who else do I have to ask? And she understands that there's pathos in this response, even though what he's projecting in his mind or what he's hypothesizing in his mind is repellent to her. There's a kind of pathos in the whole interaction of, you know, him showing her the papers and then asking her what she thinks.
Okay, well, Jane, but it seems to me that in this novel, given these ideas about marriage, what we see as readers seems to be something from Mars.
Well, I hope so.
Yes, exactly. This moment.
Yes, I would be really sad if readers came up to me and said, you know, boy, this is so much like my marriage. How did you? That would be really sad for me. I see their marriage as a phenomenon in a way that comments on the state of marriage or on the nature of marriage, let's say. But, you know, in our day, a woman who was in a relationship like this would have recourse. You know, at least she could go to a marriage counselor or a psychotherapist or somebody like that and express her views, but I think, or her feelings. But I think what, for Margaret, she's terrified that if she expresses her feelings, even to herself, then they'll gel somehow. And then she'll have nowhere to go. Then she will have no recourse. One of the characters does get a divorce, but she's only, in California, she's only allowed a divorce when her husband's mistress produces a baby. Just buying the house wasn't enough to make him divorceable. The mistress had to produce an illegitimate child in order for the husband to be divorced.
So it's not just adultery.
No, and it's not just beatings. I mean, the laws were very strict, and they would have laughed Margaret out of the room, out of the courtroom, if she'd asked for a divorce.
So that inadvertently, life, the way you register evidence, the way you draw conclusions, life is a form of gaslighting. You know, you're always being fooled into thinking that you're being victimized. The problem seems to be
living. What is the thing that is Margaret's solace? It's the friendship that she has with this other man who's actually interested in her. You know, not interested in her in any special way, but just his nature is to be honestly communicative, you know, to listen and to speak in a way that acknowledges the being of the other person. So that's all she needs. Is her problem just a piece of bad luck, you know, that she doesn't know people like that, or that she happens to seem so bland that nobody acknowledges her humanity? Or is that like most people, you know, to find that person who is willing and interested and capable of being actually intimate with you, and not in an extreme sense, but just in a day-to-day sense. You know, what's going on with you? I hear you. You know, is that, how many of those people do we find in our lives? You know, some, not a whole lot.
Well, it's so moving, because at the end of this novel, Margaret, who until this point If she had been asked, well, what's interesting about you? She might have honestly said, nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
Nothing. Now is beginning to be able to say, perhaps, well, when I was 5, I attended a public hanging.
Yes.
Oh, really? What was that like? And before, she would have said, I don't remember. But now she can tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm someone to whom interesting things happened from the year 5 when I attended a public hanging, and then I was married to a man who was very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you the story. Suddenly, her birth into the new age is to be able to tell the story of herself.
She has self-consciousness. Now, there is a moment in that last scene that I still find very poignant. It has to do with a 5-year-old understanding the nature of life, I think. Even a child as young as 5.
So
the cruel nature of life.
It's ultimately everything is seen only from the limits of a point of view that can't know any more than a mad genius can know. No one can know what they're not understanding at any given moment. And that seems to be the secret of this novel.
Yes. You know, I think Margaret does have talents in terms of empathy and understanding the people around her. But these are not valued talents, certainly not by Andrew, and not necessarily by the other people around her. She's quiet. She's observant. She sees how things work. She likes people. She's drawn to people. But what value is that? Especially in a woman who can't have any children. She would have been a great mom, and she doesn't get the chance.
I've been speaking with Jane Smiley, author most recently of Private Life. It's a novel about a marriage over time, published by Knopf. Thank you, Jane, for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Private Life at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with special assistance today from J.C. Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
The ages back to days of old, when knights were bold and books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. The jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.